you're doing.
Yeah, it would be farce, but for the seriousness of it. And when you mentioned people taking shelter, many of them wounded and sick in the courtyard of the hospital and buried alive under these bulldozers. I read another account yesterday coming from the Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. There's the story of a 12-year-old, Dunia, who had previously been underneath a bombing, an air bombing, and had lost a leg because of it. She was recovering in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis when the hospital was shelled by a tank and killed in her hospital bed.
Yeah, Dunia was a special human being. I mean, obviously no child deserves to die, and many children have died. In Dunia's case, because her story was so extraordinary, we're able to put a story to that particular, like, gruesome killing. And so we know that Dunia, she was, I believe, 12. And we know that Dunia had dreams, that she had been thinking of becoming a doctor, that she had wondered about becoming a lawyer after her leg was amputated. We know that so many members of her family were killed. And we sort of saw her fighting through that and being resilient and insisting that she would stay in her place and thinking about the future. And she was such a beautiful human being. You could pick it up just by looking at her smile and her engagement with the world around her, despite all of the pain and suffering that she experienced. In a sense, there's a lot of people sort of consider the dead to be the lucky ones because that's the end of their journey on this earth. And in that sense, you know, I guess I'm grateful that her suffering is over. But Dunia had so many years, so much happiness ahead of her in life, and it was taken from her, just like thousands, tens of thousands at this point, of children who had futures, who had lives, who had dreams and ambitions, who wanted to do things, who were begging the world to say stop to what's going on.
There's worse than what we're describing right now. Norwegian doctor Mads Gilbert reported yesterday, and he's worked in Shifa as well, as have you, that the head of the hospital's emergency department, Dr. Hani Al-Haytham, you can correct my pronunciation, was, quote, brutally murdered by Israel, along with his beloved wife, Dr. Samira Ghifari, and their five children. This is a theme of this onslaught where people are being killed in their homes with their entire families. And these are directed, targeted assassinations.
Yeah. Chris, do you have that tweet in front of you by chance?
The Dunia?
No. The one about Dr. Hani.
I can find it though.
Yeah, maybe find it because I think we should name the children.
Oh,
right,
there were
five children.
I do, and I do have the names of the children. The children are Shireen and Tia and Samir and Wafa and Sarah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we have to recognize that those people had lives too. And so often, I mean, Hani, the killing of Hani really got to me. I've been grieving it since I heard about it on Sunday. And Hani was such a beautiful human being. He was a good person who cared deeply about everything around him. But, you know, I've sort of been trying to assemble my thoughts. I'm going to try to write about Hani because Hani wasn't just a wonderful human being who was a good emergency doctor. He was an accomplished doctor. So before he went into emergency, when I met Hani, Hani is my age. He's a year younger than me. And when I met Hani over 10 years ago in 2011, he was still a neurosurgeon. Okay, he would have been 28 at the time, 28, 29. And when Hani was 28, 29, which in doctor years is still when you're a baby, he had accomplished some of the most incredible things in neurosurgery that could be accomplished. There was a doctor who he worked with who was also incredible and obviously, you know, mentored him through it. But Hani didn't want the patients in Gaza to have to leave Gaza to do complex surgeries. And so he helped pioneer complex neurosurgery in Gaza. They did a bunch of firsts, a bunch of firsts. The first time that a tumor was removed from inside the head in Gaza, that was his knife. That was his knife. The first time that some of these very complex cranial surgeries happened that involved the bone as well, the cranium. When that happened, his knife was on those patients. When he turned 30, he had already accomplished what most of us would dream of accomplishing in a full lifetime. And when I talked to him about some of his accomplishments, it was shortly after the 2012 war. You know, he said, you know, Tarek, I don't want to do neurosurgery because when a war happens, like, we're not doing much. We're not doing anything. I want to do the emergency work. He was really interested in being there right at the beginning and in taking that mentality of making it so that Palestinian patients could get care from Palestinian doctors in Palestine. That was his work on neurosurgery, and that was his work in emergency. So Hani al-Haytham wasn't just a father, a loving father, a loving husband who was killed. Hani al-Haytham was building Palestine's medical system along with all of his colleagues. Hani al-Haytham was... was making sure that they were wanting for nothing when they're wounded. And what he did in that emergency department, he shepherded it through some of the largest reconstruction in its history over the past 2 to 3 years. He shepherded it through a complete transformation. Because of him, thousands of people are still alive today from this war who would have been dead because of his work. So Hani al-Haytham is dead. But his students, his colleagues like me, the people around him, you know, his legacy, that can't be killed. That won't be killed. So I think, you know, we recognize him. He was a giant. And again, like, the man was a giant in the emergency field, and he had just turned 40 last year. He had just turned 40, you know, and he was a giant. He fucking dominated, excuse my language, he dominated neurosurgery. And then he came to dominate emergency medicine. It was incredible. He had so much to give and so much to do, and it's been robbed from us. And Chris, before I stop on that, I also want to mention his wife, because his wife was an accomplished physician herself. You know, I didn't work with her, so I can't eulogize her. But she had done so much in the field of primary care and in the things that she had worked on, like diabetes care. And so she was a giant on her own too. And they were raising those five children. They had options. They could have gone anywhere they wanted. And they were raising those five children to be the best citizens, the best people, the best Palestinians that they could be.
A year into this bloodbath with so many families dead, buried beneath the rubble, or bombed as they fled, with the drones and tanks and fighter jets always nearby, making sure that this will be another day when people die, in their hundreds, in their thousands, mostly women and kids, buried beneath the buildings in which they had hid, in Baghdad, Beirut, Beta, they can see the missiles crest as they sail from east to west. And on the streets below, no one can deny that all the people there are cheering as they look up at the sky. After all the assassinations, all those blinded maimed, after all the thousands of innocents claimed, sentenced to starve or to be buried alive, wondering if any member of their family might survive, wondering if in this world, if justice has an arc, and it began in some silo with the initial spark, and it rose into the air and came down onto military targets on Israeli ground. On the streets below, no one can deny that all the people there are cheering as they look up at the sky. The announcement came on the radio from the United States. Hunker down now, the Reesers left the gates. And in Iran and Iraq, Lebanon and Palestine, people went outside to hear the engines whine and to see the Fatah rockets speeding on their way, lighting up the night as if it were the day, giving those who lost so much a moment of respite as they watched the fireworks so brilliantly bright. On the streets below, no one can deny that all the people there are cheering as they look up at the sky. A year into this bloodbath with so many families dead.
David Rovics again, his song, The Ark of Justice. And underneath all of these intros is the song The Box from Orbital, and it comes from Grant Wakefield's 1992 disc, The Fire This Time, on the first Gulf War. Well, as mentioned, Israel's terror war of conquest has spread to Lebanon. The entity frames its land grab as defensive as ever, even as it carpet bombs Beirut and erases entire villages in southern Lebanon, making of it a buffer zone for northern settlement. Benjamin Netanyahu and his generals, I wrote in November, promised they would make a Gaza of Beirut, and they've been as good as their word. Israel has killed thousands and made more than a million people homeless in Lebanon, most of those through bombing attacks against high-rise apartment blocks. And as with its obliteration of Gaza, Israel's justification for the civilian carnage is a hunt for members of Hezbollah, hiding, it says, beneath the flats and hospitals and other vital infrastructure, using the population as a human shield. Well, I spoke with Laith Maarouf several times in 2024, the last time in late November. Laith is a Canadian-Palestinian living now in Beirut, where he's executive director of FreePalestine.video, an independent news organization providing coverage of what it says is, quote, the absence of media supporting the resistance forces in the English language due to the ban in the West. Now, Laith, we're getting some coverage of Israel's blitzkrieg over Beirut, but the language at the CBC remains sickeningly passive. What, Laith, should Canadians know about what's happening right now that they're not getting from their national broadcaster?
Yes, so the Zionists were trying to terrorize the population of Beirut and the government of Lebanon into submitting to a surrender deal before the American negotiator Hochstein, who happens to be also a former Israeli officer, was going to come to Beirut. So today Hochstein was here in Lebanon, but the day before, the Israelis attacked three locations within 24 hours within the municipality of Beirut proper. One of those attacks was 500 meters away from the parliament of Lebanon and was targeted attack on the home and offices of the mayor of the neighborhood, so an elected official. And the other attacks were on the edges of Beirut from the other side. So they were trying to kind of like draw a belt around the city of fire. And what ended up happening is that Hezbollah responded in kind, attacking Tel Aviv, but still not attacking civilian infrastructure or buildings. In fact, they attacked one of the offices of the Mossad in the heart of Tel Aviv. And the negotiator of the U.S. arrived today, as I said. He met with the Speaker of the House, Nabih Berri, head of the Amal Party, and the Prime Minister, caretaker Prime Minister. And both of them rejected any surrender conditions and insisted that the only thing that is a reference is the United Nations Resolution 1701, which guarantees that the Zionists cease to violate Lebanese sovereignty. And just an hour after Hochstein left, the new Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Naeem Qasem, spoke to the nation in a recorded statement and said that they will not be accepting any conditions that violate the sovereignty of Lebanon and that they are ready for a prolonged war of attrition and that they will not negotiate away the sovereignty of Lebanon, no matter what.
Well, and now the Speaker of the Parliament, CBC, says that he has the imprimatur of Hezbollah to, so he is speaking for both the Parliament and Hezbollah when he talks to the American, his American interlocutor, the Israeli soldier, former soldier that you described?
Yes, so Hezbollah has given him the authority to negotiate on their behalf, but they definitely trust Nabih Berri because the Amal Party is the other Shi'ab in Lebanon and is engaged actually on the ground in the south of Lebanon in defending the country. It's this partnership between Hezbollah and Amal that keeps the country safe.
Israel has continued its pattern of targeting high officials. They killed Hezbollah's Mohammed Afif. He's the media liaison for the organization. Do you think this is because they feel, the Israelis do, that this is a way to keep any messaging out of the Western press?
Yes. So one of those three attacks that I mentioned a day ago inside Beirut proper was on the headquarters of the Ba'ath Party, the Lebanese branch of the Ba'ath Party. And Mr. Mohammed Afif, the media relations director of Hezbollah, was assassinated in that attack. He has been very, very active, especially since the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the former secretary general of Hezbollah, in taking media and public space. And he has been organizing almost daily tours for the international media to show them the terrorist actions of the Zionist colony, the results of them on the grounds here in Lebanon. And that was definitely irking the Zionists. He did say in one of his last press conference, I'm talking about Afif, that, you know, he knows that his media presence and all his public work is increasing the possibility that he will be assassinated and martyred. And clearly, that's what happened. The Zionists can't stand anybody that doesn't fear them, that publicly takes positions against them. And the firebrand position of Mohammed Afif and his amazing work in bringing all the international media to the reality on the ground in Lebanon cost him his life, and he gladly gave it to the freedom of his nation.
Well, I describe in the introduction Israel's bombing of Lebanon as a blitzkrieg. The blitzkrieg was the Nazi Germany the tactic meant in the Second War to terrify the citizenry, thinking that the citizens would put pressure on the leadership and the military to surrender. It was proven to be an ineffective tactic back then, and it has been every time it's been repeated. What about the situation, the morale in Beirut right now? What result is the Israeli blitzkrieg having on Lebanese resolve?
I think it only actually strengthened the resolve of the Lebanese people. Any schism that may have existed before, any criticism for Hezbollah and its actions that existed are practically all dissipated and gone. And this is because the Zionists have went overboard. I mean, they want to create a civil war in Lebanon by, getting the Maronite sect, for instance, to, you know, do what it did in the 1980s and 70s. But they're persisting of attacking churches in Lebanon. There's up to 12 now churches destroyed across Lebanon. This definitely turned the Christian population against the Zionists. Similarly, their insistence on attacking Sunni areas of Lebanon and attacking the Palestinian refugee camps and the Islamic group, which is a Sunni party here in Lebanon that's Lebanese, that all again turned the Sunni population against the Zionists. In fact, the actions of Hezbollah in coming to the defense of the Shia, of the Sunni population of Gaza and the Christian population of Palestine, while the majority of Sunni states in the world just abandoning the population of Gaza and the majority of the Christian states in the world abandoning the Christians of Palestine, has made Hezbollah a hero in the eye of those communities, and is, you know, any sectarian feelings that the West invested in for decades to create a schism between the Shia, Sunnis, and the Christians of the Levant area with their Muslim brothers and sisters is now gone. Billions of dollars invested into that scheme of internal strife that the West has built its plan on for decades is gone.
Since recording that with Laith in November, there's been dramatic changes in the situation in Lebanon. A ceasefire of sorts was signed between the governments of Lebanon and Israel. Seeing Hezbollah agreeing to stop its attacks, Israel has incidentally broken the terms repeatedly, so far without retribution from Hezbollah or recrimination from its Western partners. And of course, the government in Syria has fallen, bringing to an end the 50-plus year Assad family rule there. Astonishingly, Bashar al-Assad, in power as president since the year 2000, fled the country on a Russian jet as his army evaporated, surrendering the country to the head-chopping horde armed and aided by Turkey, Israel, and the Western powers, with hardly a shot fired. What this means for Syrians is clear, as marauding gangs of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HST, the Salafi jihadist transnational terrorists, formerly known as ISIS, and Jabhat al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda's branch outfit in Syria, are killing and chopping heads in the streets. But what losing its naval and air bases in Syria means for Russia is another question. I spoke to John Helmer, principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears, about the stunning collapse of Syria and his then-recent article, The Russian General Staff, Kremlin Discussing Holding the Latakia Saniak to Defend Bases, Agree to Withdraw Under Turkish Safe Passage a few weeks ago. Here's John.
There was a decision in Moscow not to react, not to defend, not to deter. Now, that begins to be understood in retrospect. So our surprise is an indication of how the publics of Russia and the rest of the world have been deceived by political decisions made at the top of Russian leadership not to disclose what was coming. Now, why is that? Because President Putin has all along rated protection of Israel to attack Syria of higher priority than supporting the sovereignty of Syria and the preservation of Bashar al-Assad's regime in Damascus or its future relationship with Syrian opposition groups. In addition, President Putin has supported as a higher priority Russia's relations with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey. In addition, President Putin has placed as a high priority Russian interest in reaching an accommodation with the incoming Trump regime for the future of the war in Europe, the war in the Ukraine. So essentially, Russia's military intelligence, the GRU, the general staff, the commanders in Syria had their hands tied behind their backs because they were not allowed to contest Israeli offensives in Syria, Turkish offensives around and coming out of Idlib in the northeast, and American offensives launched from Al-Tanf in the southeast of Syria up to the Iraqi border and covering Syrian oil production at Deir ez-Zor. So you've got a situation, in retrospect, obvious. Syria has been partitioned in three. Israel now takes southern Syria up to the Damascus suburbs. Damascus is about to become a Jewish city. In the northeast, we have Turkish power, meaning Turkish weapons, Turkish troops, Turkish armored cars, Turkish tanks and artillery, establishing themselves all the way down through the Sanjak of Latakia to the Lebanese border. And we have the American force extending itself all the way northwards in the east to the Iraqi border. That means there's been a strategic defeat of not only the Assad regime in Damascus, and the strategic defeat of sovereign Syria by the three external powers. And the two defending powers, the two powers that defended the Syrian sovereignty and in territorial integrity, Russia and Iran, have been defeated. That sounds like a surprise, but to the decision makers of each of those states, it's not quite the surprise it looks.
Thanks to John Helmer. Well, of course, and as usual, there was much more topic than time last year, and as there is every week. Thanks to David Rovics, Grant Wakefield, and the Protest Music Project, and to Tarek Lubani, Laith Maruf, John Helmer, CJSF, and to all those supporting Palestine. A happier New Year's for you all. That's all I've got. Until the next time.
I gotta think that we're not alone.
I'm sitting in my house watching all this happen, and I've arrived to a point where I just can't keep my mouth shut anymore.
Guerrilla Radio, you're not alone.